You're listening to the Not Your Average Culture podcast, where we have candid conversations about personal growth, business, and creativity. Because let's be honest, creative or not, life can get messy, especially if you are a creative entrepreneur. But you don't have to go at it alone. There's a whole community and culture around the lifestyle of creatives. So here on this podcast, I'm making the space to have open conversations with a wide range of dynamic people about how to successfully maintain your business, keep your sanity, while owning your authenticity and staying inspired along this journey. I'm your host, Chardonnay. Let's get to it. Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Not Your Average Culture podcast. Today, I'm going to be chatting with someone who I have had the pleasure to work with and film many projects for, but the project we are going to be talking about in today's episode is something we have been filming for the past almost 2 years, and we are finally at a point where we are going to share it and potentially start submitting it to film festivals and things of that nature. And I am just beyond excited to share this conversation with you all, because for the folks who might be tuning into this season of the podcast for the very first time, the theme of this season is creative flow. And I recommend you listen to or revisit the intro episode for this season, because I talk about what creative flow means to me, the journey and the process of pursuing a creative career path, while also figuring out how you find your tribe, your network, your community, and support system when you are pursuing a professional goal, a passion project, or maybe even a creative outlet. This intro episode pairs well with the conversation I'm sharing today, because there are people out here pursuing their personal goals and making those professional strides and seeking knowledge and resources and education and redefining what success looks like despite having a criminal background and being formerly incarcerated. So this is such an empowering conversation, and I'm delighted to share it with you all. So let's dive into this episode. I'm really excited, and thank you for finally being a guest on the podcast. It's crazy because I feel like we've worked a lot. You have hired me for a lot of other projects, which I'm grateful and thankful for. And so it only seems natural and right to have you now to come and be a guest on the podcast, because we just completed a project. And so we'll get more into that in a bit. But before we dive into that, I have a little icebreaker question for you. If you could create a sequel to any movie, what would it be and why?
Wow. that's a great question. I kind of would like to see a sequel to Boys in the Hood, because I wanted to see how the main character Trey and, you know, his girlfriend that was played by Nia Long, I wanted to see how they turned out, kind of like when they went away to a historically Black college. So if I could pick one movie, it would probably be Boys in the Hood. That would, you know, I wanted to see how those characters shaped out.
That's what's up. And that's a classic movie. So I'm happy that that's a good one. And the reason why I asked you that question is because the main thing that we're going to talk about in today's episode is your documentary. But before we get there, can you first share with listeners a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do?
No problem. So my name is Dr. Robert Mossy Alexander. I've been in education over 15 years as a counselor and instructor. I'm the chair of counseling at De Anza College. And my main thing is helping students transfer from community college to four-year colleges. In that, I try to gravitate towards the students that are coming from marginalized communities like me. I'm from East Oakland and, you know, born and raised, you know, in the Bay Area. I've noticed that a lot of students that are coming from urban areas, they don't see higher education as a way for upward mobility, a way of making money. So I've tried to be the catalyst in bridging that gap and showing them that community college or higher education in general is a way for you to potentially make a lot of money and just be, you know, an amazing member, contributing member of society.
You know, that's the one thing that I do appreciate about you, even in like your answer of asking what movie would you want to see a sequel to? Like you mentioned, like the HBCU. And I feel like you're someone who walks the walk and talks the talk, and it always kind of circles back to education. And so like with you just even introducing yourself, you're an author, a father, educator, entrepreneur, and I guess you can now say like a director. What would you say your why is behind all of the things that you do? Now, obviously, you know, because we live in America, if we make a little coin from things, that's cool. But what is the deeper thing behind, you know, all the things that you have done and the things that you do?
Absolutely. That's a great question, Charnay. So you being, you know, my business partner, my videographer, an amazing producer, I have always set out to create art that reflects life. And my why behind it is just to continue to bridge the gap between urban communities and, you know, what's happening in higher ed. I love helping marginalized communities. So, you know, that's why this documentary is based on Justice Impacted. Folks, I'm Justice Impacted. It happened when I was 18. And I feel like society, you know, kind of looks down. Not kind of. They look down on folks that have been incarcerated, right? There is overwhelming negative portrayals of people that, you know, are reentry folks, or, you know, coming out of prison and trying to make a better life for themselves, even though it was a mistake. So, you know, my why behind everything I do is to combine art with activism, right? I'm an artivist. That's what I am. You know, I didn't make up that expression, but when I heard it, I said, okay, that's me. You know, that's me in a nutshell. And I don't do it for money, just like you mentioned. I've had a full-time job. Now, you know, you can't get rich from being in education, but it has provided for me. You know, I've bought homes. I've been able to help my own kids through college. So this is all passion. And if I am able to make a little something on it, then great. But that's not the impetus in terms of creating the work that I've created. I want to help folks. I want there to be some type of guiding light, right? So many of my stories, they have to do with, you know, positive change, right? So that Black and brown communities, right? We say BIPOC, right? Black, Indigenous, and people of color. Most of my stories evolve around BIPOC community and, you know, creating just better opportunities.
That's what's up. And, you know, as you were speaking, there's a quote or a saying that the great Nina Simone used to always say, like, how can you call yourself an artist? And I may be saying the quote wrong, but she says, like, how can you call yourself an artist if your art doesn't reflect the times? And so I feel like with, you know, even some of the books that you've written or just the project that we work on, it reflects the times. And so I'm curious for you, like with you pursuing, you know, your higher education or even just your career, how do you balance kind of you and your reality and how you have to navigate in the world in conjunction with like this corporate life and kind of how we have to put on, I don't know, I feel like a different hat, I want to say, as we navigate these dualities in life. You know, how have you navigated that?
So, you know, navigating, you know, the corporate life, or should I say the educational world and who I am as a person, it could be challenging at times because they use this term code switching. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to talk with King's English. And then when you get around the homies, you use slang and you kind of let your hair down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of times folks have a hard time bringing their authentic self to the table, to the forefront. Right. Over time, I had to learn that I had to be me as much as possibly, you know, in my career. So even with students or teaching a class, I still talk with slang. Right. Now, there's a level of professionalism. There is decorum that I use. You know, I'm in meetings with the president of the college. I'm in meetings with the vice president. I'm in meetings with my dean. So don't get it twisted. There's a level of professionalism that I use, but I'm one of those folks that I try to tear down the walls or the status quo, right? Education is not just for white men anymore. It's for everybody, right? So the status quo originally was, you know, my particular school, De Anza College, we were created in 1967. So when our school was built, they may not have Black and Latino folks in mind. But now that the student population has changed, we have to hire faculty and staff that reflect the student population.
Mm-hmm.
And students don't necessarily want to see, they don't want to see folks, you know, that are straight up and down or, you know, Poindexters. They want to see flavor. So I infuse classes with flavor. I let students know about me. And that's where me being a storyteller kind of comes in, because I always share short stories, whether it's in class, right, or on one-on-one situations, one-on-one counseling sessions that I'm having with my students, because I feel like what better way for them to see that there is a path to success than hearing it from their mentor, hearing it from their teacher, hearing it from their counselor. So, you know, now that I'm the chair of counseling, I host these in-service trainings. I do professional development, and many of my colleagues, they'll tell me at the end of our in-service training that, hey, the way you led this presentation or who you had come in to guest speak, that's been inspiring. Keep doing what you're doing. I love that you're bringing your own energy, your own flavor. So I will tell listeners this. If you ever have an opportunity, you're in a corporate setting, you know, don't do it at the expense of losing your job, but being who you are and being authentic to who you are, that's going to help you, you know, for the duration of your career, right? You want that. You want people to see what you're about, right? And that's just my goal. That's what I do.
That's what's up. And I feel like I'm going to switch gears a little bit, and we are going to start talking more about the documentary. And I feel like that's kind of what you have, in a way, brought to the forefront, because as you previously mentioned, you know, you had a moment in your journey where you were previously incarcerated. And so you don't hide that, and you share that story. And something that you mentioned in one of our work sessions, I can't remember exactly how you said it word for word, but you was like, for the next 30 to 45 minutes of this film, like, I want to hijack the audience attention. And you really want the viewers to, you know, watch this documentary and make it be something that's engaging and captivating. So I'm curious for you, what is it that you hope people take away after watching this documentary that we put together? And who would you say that this documentary is for?
That's a great question, Chardonnay. So, you know, I hope my audience just recognizes the pervasive stigma and systemic challenges faced by those that are reintegrating into society post-incarceration. I want to hijack the viewers' mind, listening, and how they perceived folks that are justice impacted. You know, my main thing, like you and I have already discussed, is to shift the public perception of justice impacted folks. Because overwhelmingly, you know, people that are justice impacted have been overshadowed by negative portrayals, right? So the other thing I'm trying to do is create advocacy for creating programs that help justice impacted folks, okay? And I think a well-crafted story, right, or a well-crafted narrative is going to bring about empathy, it's going to challenge biases, you know, it's going to shift the societal attitudes that we have about folks that have been incarcerated, okay? And viewers will get a chance to see, from the testimonials that we had in our documentary, they're going to see transformation. They're going to see resilience. They're going to see aspirations of individuality, right? And they're also going to see how folks just did an amazing job of overcoming barriers and triumphs that are associated with reintegration, okay? So whenever somebody tells a story, writes a book, or creates a documentary, that could be used as a catalyst for social change. It could be used as a catalyst for creating empathy. And since the title of this documentary is called Reclaiming Our Humanity, it's going to humanize the experiences of formerly incarcerated folks, right? So as I mentioned, I'm just as impacted as I was reintegrating back into society. I'm looking for an inclusive, supportive community of folks, you know, that could potentially see that this was just a mistake, and this is my opportunity for a second chance. And we use the term redemption in our documentary. So that's the main. These are some of the main tenets of Reclaiming Our Humanity. And you guys, you must watch this. This is a great film. The original question is, who is it designed for? It's designed for everybody. It's not just designed for people that are reacclimating back to society, but it also is designed for that youngster, that young person, young folks that might be at the crossroads of making a bad decision. Because you and I, Chardonnay, we're not glorifying criminalization at all. What we did is show our viewers that it was 10 times harder to make a way out of no way, but it can be done. So if I can capture young folks' attention, right, and showing that, okay, I don't want to go that route. I can learn from these gentlemen, right, that have already experienced negative setbacks, you know, by being incarcerated, and how hard it was for them to become a superintendent of BART, to become a professor, to become a healing circle leader, to become a football coach. And these are all the gentlemen that I was fortunate enough to interview in the documentary. So, you know, twofold, capture that young person's mind, right? You don't have to make a mistake to learn from mistakes. You know, a wise person could learn from other folks' mistakes. And then also just showing support and showing love and showing, you know, admiration for folks that have been incarcerated and how they found a way. So that's what it's for. It's for everybody.
You know, I feel like as you were responding, I'm like, I don't know if we've been working together for too long, where you just kind of, you knew what questions I was going to ask, because you started answering some questions that I have written down over here on my end before I even got a chance to ask them, or if my questions are just predictable. But, you know, we got a chance to ask the people who we sat down and interviewed, you know, what was their mindset shift or what helped them kind of make that transition to prevent them from being reincarcerated again. But I don't think I ever got a chance to ask you, what was that mindset shift or thing, that kind of light bulb moment for you, where it was like, you know what, like, despite my past, despite this mistake that I had, I'm still going to pursue a higher education. I'm still going to write a book. I'm still going to do and go after all the things that I want to do, despite having this as a part of my background. I'm wondering for you, what was that moment for you?
Great question. Great question, Chardonnay. So what I want the listeners to take from this podcast is, you know, this documentary came out of my dissertation. You know, this is 4 years of research. This isn't anything that happened overnight. You know, this came from not only extensive research, you know, from me, but also extensive research from you and interviews that we did over the last 2 years. So there were several common factors that emerged from the research that we did. I want to talk about a few reoccurring things. So one of the reoccurring things, you know, I set out to prove that education and mentorship was going to be the catalyst, you know, for helping justice impacted find success post-incarceration. So, you know, we know that having a strong support network is going to be effective, right? So having a strong support network, that can encompass family, friends, mentors, community organizations, right? So, you know, me working at San Quentin, for Mount Tamalpais College, we have a lot of community-based organizations coming in. And sometimes those folks are from the greater Bay Area community, but sometimes those mentors were folks that were incarcerated, like the people that they're helping. So we have this kind of mythology that, you know, you have to hear from somebody that, you know, it, you know, has a doctorate or somebody that never got in trouble at all. But what we found doing our research and our interviews is sometimes the best people to hear it from are the folks that went through the exact same thing that they went through. And we call them trusted messengers, right? So once we establish that it doesn't necessarily need to be someone that, you know, has a squeaky clean record, okay, now we know that anybody could be a mentor as long as they're steering you in the right path. So other themes that emerged from our research and interviews is education, and not only education, but having a skill. So skill development played a pivotal role, right? And this ties into one of our interviewees, Marlon Lewis, who got a janitorial certificate while he was in Lompoc. He also got several units towards his college graduation that he was able to transfer and eventually get a bachelor's and then a master's in business. So we know that skill development plays a part. Learning and acquiring new skills is vital, right? Learning and acquiring new skills is going to enhance anybody's employability. And it builds your self-confidence. So now you have something that you have something to lose. You have gone through a training. And when you have something to lose, whether it's thinking about your family, that makes you steer clear from crime because you don't want to put yourself back in a situation where it's going to impact your community and your family and friends that look up to you. And you want to foster, you want to use the skill that you learn. So the other things that emerged was having a resilient mindset and determination, right? These people want to break the cycle of criminal behavior, right? And this was consistent throughout our interviews. No one grows up saying, oh, I want to be a lifelong criminal. We don't say that in elementary school, but sometimes it's systemic things that happen. Sometimes it's the educational system itself not fostering our abilities or learning about us or being culturally relevant in terms of figuring out what we're good at and how it connects to employability in the future, right? So all of our participants made a commitment to not only personal growth, but they want to leverage their past mistakes and be a catalyst for positive change. Right. Whether it was a violent crime, I have folks that lead healing circles, right, that, you know, do restorative justice training inside of Oakland Unified School District. OK, this is one of my good buddies who sometimes is on speed. There's a Gary Malachi Scott. Right. So another thing that emerged from just talking to Shaka Senghor, who is a best-selling author, is There not only needs to be accountability, but there needs to be emotional and psychological support. So that can mean going to a therapist. Talking to a therapist is a unique experience because it helps you navigate the emotional challenges associated with reentry. So you will find all of these topics touched on in Reclaiming Our Humanity.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering for you, hindsight after, you know, going through this whole journey and process, and even just in before creating the documentary, of your journey of being like a creative entrepreneur, is there anything that you would have done differently, hindsight, looking back at your journey, your experience of all of your different creative pursuits?
I think the main thing I would have done differently, Charnay, is maybe raising more money up front, because this was a very expensive process. You and I had to fly out of town.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to get a sponsor then in the interim, so I got a little bit of money to help out with that. But you know, I would have started some type of a fundraising campaign long before, you know, we even started the process. But you don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm a first time documentary maker. This isn't going to be my last.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to do something around culture and education. But having the resources and having the funds, you know, at your disposal to use to, you know, hire a sound engineer. You know, maybe hire an additional videographer, right, to get different angles, getting more B-roll. Mm-hmm. These are all things that I'm going to do a better job of doing in the next documentary. So, yeah, fundraising is something that's paramount.
And I'm happy you touched on that because I feel like this is a challenge that not only in our process of working together, but I think in anybody who might relate to being like a creative or entrepreneur, it's like, what comes first? Like, do you go on like a tour or sprint of just like trying to raise funds to get people and convince people of like, hey, invest in my idea, invest in this project? Or do you just take the resources that you have and do with what you have and put out there like, okay, I can't wait for anybody to invest in me. I'm just going to work with what I have and show people like this is a part of the ladder up and the bigger picture of other projects and things that I want to do. It's kind of like, do you invest in yourself or do you invest in, you know, these pitches and apply for grants and fellowships for other people to invest in you? And so I'm happy you touched on that. And I guess I'm also curious, what made you just kind of pull the trigger and be like, you know what, I'm going to self-fund this. I'm not waiting to fundraise or get the money from anybody else. Like, yep. What do you feel like was the pressure behind you? And you was just like, you know what, I'm just going to do it and make do with what I have.
The pressure, it was on me from the get-go because I wanted to put this documentary out into the world. So initially when you and I were doing the interviews, I just thought that I was going to use it for my dissertation, right? But then looking at the footage that we collected and showing it to different educators, specifically my dissertation committee, right? Shout out to Dr. Susanna Katz and shout out to Dr. Cheryl and shout out to everybody that was on my dissertation committee. They were telling me, hey, Rob, you got something, right? And you were also telling me, hey, I think we got something powerful. So, just, you know, based on my experience being Justice Impacted, and around that time, I got hired to work at Mount Tamar Pius College. I teach intro to college class at San Quentin every Monday night. And wanting folks to just, you know, see that, okay, yeah, I had this mistake, right? But I have so many brilliant students, you know, at San Quentin that, you know, not only did I do it for me, but I did it for them. You know, I'm doing it for the community at large. Oakland, we're in a state of crisis right now. Not only do we have, you know, just a high level of small business break-ins, cars are being broken into, you know, we have gang violence, you know, people are still selling dope on the streets. So I always felt like if youngsters, you know, and it's not just young people doing it, you know, it's all ages. But I felt like if people in general, you know, had something to lose or they had an outlet for making money and they saw people come from a similar background, whether it's the neighborhood or what they've gone through, then they wouldn't be doing all of these things that, you know, that they're doing. Now, car break-ins it's going crazy right now. We refer to that as bipping. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, bipping is not a new thing. It's being more sensationalized and talked about because of social media and sometimes it's caught on camera. More people have, you know, small business cameras and home cameras and security. So, you know, I really did it, you know, for the folks that just feel like they don't have any hope.
That's real. Now, something else that you mentioned, and it's one of the last questions I'm going to ask you, but this documentary came about as you were, you know, getting your dissertation, and you actually like you were doing these things in tandem, like filming this documentary while also pursuing your doctorate at the same time. And so the theme of this season for me personally is just like creative flow and finding that sweet spot of kind of balancing work and life, because you know things can come up in your personal life and work life. And so I'm wondering for you, like, how did you fine balance of, you know, you have your passion project that you're working on, you have your doctorate, and then also you are a father, you have a full-time job. So how do you and how did you find a balance with all the pursuits that you have going on?
You know, you have to really be intentional about creating a schedule, right? And you know, creating the outline and writing, that part for me had to come in the morning. So I'm a morning person, you know, so I would encourage anybody that is a creative or anybody that is even thinking about writing a book, creating a documentary, find out when you're at your best, when you're at your peak. And for me, that's in the morning. And we use this term biorhythms. You have to be in tune with your biorhythms. So if you know that when it's past 9 o'clock at night or past 10 and you're feeling sleepy and you don't write well, you don't think well, that's not going to be you creating something. That's not going to be in tune with your biorhythms. The other thing that you and I came to an understanding is when you're dealing with important people like you, like all of the people that we interviewed are very important and they give back to the community. And many of them are creators themselves, mentors themselves. If you're important, you're going to have demands. You're going to have large demands on your time, right? So being intentional about, okay, what times work best for you, and then kind of sticking to that schedule, right? So if you and I had to go out and interview somebody, and they gave us a day and a time, then we had to do a good job of being there on time and not canceling, you know, and doing a rain check type interview. So, you know, just being patient, understanding that folks that are important or, you know, have people kind of relying on them like you and I, because that, you know, I love my kids. So I want to be ever present in my boys' lives, right? You know, I don't sacrifice holidays, you know, to be creative when it comes to birthdays, Thanksgiving, Christmas. Nothing comes before that because we you know, we either going to go out to eat or we're going to have dinner at my mom's home in Oakland, California. You know, phone is off, you know, on silent. You know, I try my best to refrain from social media on those days. But just to circle back to your question, original question, Charnay, is just being patient and knowing that people, you know, are going to have demands on their time and just making a commitment. Once you book an appointment to do something, stick to it.
That's what's up. And I feel like I'm going to wrap up the podcast on a fun and light note with a few random pop questions to just leave listeners with a fun call to action and takeaway for the day. So I like to call this like the cultural challenge or cultural round. But if you could write your own law that everyone had to follow, what would it be and why? Since we're on the topic of like justice and things of that nature.
Woo, you are coming with it today, Charnay. If I could write my own law, the law would be that if somebody, anybody, was reintegrating into society, the city that they come from and or the city that they are going to re-enter into, there has to be some type of support system involved that's going to help them find housing, get an employable job, and it has to be linked to therapy. So those three things. This has to be mandatory. This is going to be mandatory for anybody that is coming out of prison. Those three things need to be in place. A place to live, employability, and therapy. This is a mandatory law.
Nice, nice. I think a lot of folks will be like, yeah, when are you running? When are you running? So my next question is, just from working with you, I know you kind of like to dabble in a little bit of fashion here and there. So I'm wondering, if you wore a pair of shoes, what kind would you be?
You know what? You know, I'm a product of the 80s, and you are right about the fashion thing. It's going to have to be some patent leather Jordan, probably Jordan 11s, you know, because I feel like you can parlay, you can wear those with dress up shoes, I mean, with dress up clothes as well. You know, they are, to me, they are flexible in that regard. So, my kids always say, you know, Dad, J's are going to eventually fade out. So I don't know. I don't think that's true. I don't buy it.
They not going nowhere. Okay. I'm personally a heel type of gal, but anybody who stands behind a pair of J's, like, you know, I work with them. So
I knew you would respect that being from Chicago. I knew it.
For sure. And my last question, if a movie was made about your life, what genre would it be and who would you want to play you?
Wow. Okay. If a movie was made about my life, it's going to be comedic. It's definitely going to be comedic, but it will have some drama in it, right? Cause I went through drama and I'm probably going to experience some more drama. And I would probably like the rapper Cordae to play me. Cause I like him. I just think he's intelligent. I just think the young man is going places. So Cordae, the rapper, and it would be a dramedy, you know, comedy and drama.
Comedy and drama. That's interesting. Why did you pair comedy with drama?
I think my life has had some funny moments. Sometimes that's how I communicate with people, is like telling a joke, or, you know, I will infuse humor into a training that I'm doing. But my life has also had some ups and downs. And that's why, you know, you and I created this documentary, because I came out of something and I made a dark situation have light. Mm-hmm. So that's me in a nutshell.
Nice. So that pretty much wraps it up for me. And that's all the questions that I have. But do you have any final thoughts you want to share? How can people connect with you? Where can people find and watch the documentary? Just, you know, tell us all the details.
Absolutely. I want to shout you out, my business partner, Charnay Mason Creations. I want to shout out my wife, Cassie Alexander. I want to shout out my children. Some are in California, but some are out of state. You guys can find this documentary on hoodtohighereducation.com. That's hood2highereducation.com. Hoodtohighereducation.com is also on all social media platforms. And just stay tuned, because this is the first installment, but there may be a sequel to this. So yeah, check me out on Hood to Higher Education. Thank you so much for the opportunity, Charnay, to just chop it up with you. This has been amazing, and I hope to do it again.
So there it is, everyone. This concludes this episode. The most fulfilling part of this conversation for me was when Robert spoke about having a solid support system. I think in this current time, we believe support is just commenting, liking, or sharing. But support, whether you have been previously incarcerated or not, support takes on so many other different shapes and forms and can show up in many different ways. I think no matter what setting you are in, this made me think about how the lack of it or access to various types of support can have an impact in someone's life. For me personally, something as simple as a client taking a chance on hiring me to capture a project, especially when it's something that relates to a serious matter such as incarceration, despite me not having major funding to back this project or a large team of people to produce this, says a lot and gave me the confidence boost and momentum to want to do more projects similar to this. And not only did I think about my experience, but I also reflected on how supporting others, despite their background, despite their experience level, despite any challenges or hiccups they may have encountered, it could be that very thing that catapults someone into being the best version of themselves, all simply because they had access to resources and support to do so. I personally wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for people who supported my ambitious dreams and lofty goals and just put me in positions to learn and connect with different types of people and also inform me about opportunities that are out here. So think about some ways you can support someone. It doesn't have to be monetarily, but maybe it's something as simple as making time to chat with someone or just tell them, I see you, and keep going. Okay. Now, with all that being said, consider supporting this podcast by sharing this episode, especially if you found value in our conversation, or by becoming a regular contributor of the podcast. I'll have links to everything we talked about and mentioned in the show notes. That's all I have to share with you all. Peace, love, and everything in between. I'm out.